A lot of psalms have similar themes to this, but this is a good representative psalm. I'd like to read it with you just to start with. I imagine many of you have read it at home and gone through your lesson already, but this will get it in the front of our minds for us to talk about. It's only 14 verses. Psalm 27, a psalm of David. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When the wicked came against me to eat up my flesh, my enemies and foes, they stumbled and fell. Though an army may encamp against me, though my heart shall not fear, though war may rise against me, in this I will be confident. One thing I have desired of the Lord, that will I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in His temple. For in the time of trouble He shall hide me in His pavilion. In the secret place of His tabernacle He shall hide me. He shall set me high upon a rock. And now my head shall be lifted up above my enemies all around me. Therefore I will offer sacrifices of joy in His tabernacle. I will sing, yes, I will sing praises to the Lord. Hear, O Lord, when I cry with my voice. Have mercy also upon me and answer me. When you said, seek my face, my heart said to you, Lord, your face, Lord, I will seek. Do not hide your face from me. Turn not your servant away in anger. You have been my help. Do not leave me nor forsake me, O God of my salvation. When my father and my mother forsake me, then the Lord will take care of me. Teach me your way, O Lord, and lead me in a smooth path because of my enemies. Do not deliver me to the will of my adversaries, for false witnesses have risen against me, and such as breathe out violence. I would have lost heart unless I had believed that I would see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait on the Lord. Be of good courage, and He shall strengthen your heart. Wait, I say, on the Lord. So, light and salvation in dark times. This is, as we've said, a Psalm of David. And it's a psalm that was evidently and obviously written during a time of danger and stress in David's life. More than likely, a time in which he was fleeing from Saul and Saul's henchmen who were out to take his life. You might remember that in David's life. And in 1 Samuel chapters 21 and 22, most traditionally at least, scholars who study this would place this psalm in that time frame. David wrote several psalms in this time frame where he's fleeing from Saul. You might remember he goes up to Nob and is fleeing. He's kind of on the run, and he gets there and he doesn't have any food, and the priest feeds him some of the showbread that's there and gives him the sword of Goliath, and he flees here and there all over the place. You might remember all of that. Mike, did you want to? Yes, several of these are quite similar, and some of them even say, you know, written during a time when he's fleeing from Saul, or as we noted in the Sunday night sermon, when he's in the cave or something like that. So this seems to fit that time frame very well as well. It's a time which, if you follow David's actions on a map, if you read through that middle to latter part of 1 Samuel, he's just really all over the country. He goes up to Gath. He's out in the desert. He's up, you know, here and over there, just all over the place, fleeing from Saul. Sometimes, initially in 1 Samuel 21, he's by himself. Later on, others gather together with him in a cave. His parents are among those. He ultimately takes his parents and leaves them in charge of the king of Moab, of all things, sort of for their protection during this time when he's fleeing around and all of that. So it's a very distressful time in David's life. And many, many times he's nearly caught, killed. You might remember the priest gives him something to eat. There's an Edomite there by the name of Doeg who later on reports it to Saul. And Saul, at the hand of Doeg, has all of the priests slaughtered. You might remember that. Only Abiathar flees that. And David feels responsible for getting all of the priests killed. He feels like that was his responsibility. And so, highly likely that this psalm is written in that time frame, where it's not just a matter of sometimes Probably in your life, you've had a time when you've said, well, everybody's out to get me. First of all, it probably wasn't everybody. And secondly, if they got you, they probably wouldn't have killed you. But it nearly was everybody in David's life out to get him. He had many, many enemies, the henchmen of Saul, and they would have killed him had they gotten a hold of him. And so that's, I think, very distressive. And we can appreciate going through the difficult time that he was going through here. There are three main sections, if you want to outline this psalm, which I suggest that you do in your Bible study. I think there's a really good approach to Bible study is outlining things when you go through and read it and then try to break it down how it falls logically. In this particular psalm, the first six verses, David is expressing a really confident trust in the Lord and a commitment to the Lord. And then, that's verses 1 through 6, and then in verses 7 through 12, he has this plea for mercy and for help during this difficult time. And then the last couple of verses, there's David's testimony that if you just have faith in God, if you believe in Him, if you wait on Him and have patience, that you will see God's goodness in the land of the living. So these are the three main sections, I think, of this wonderful and encouraging psalm. So what we want to do then is kind of go through it step by step, verse by verse now, and bring in other verses as well that talk about some of these same topics and reflect on, in a deeper way, exactly what David is trying to convey to us. You have some synonymous parallelism in the first couple of verses, especially verse 1. He calls the Lord his light and salvation and also the strength of his life. When you think about light, you're thinking about guidance, seeing a way to go, salvation, being rescued from some horrible end. God is his light, shows him the way to go. He's the rescuer of him. He is his strength. He's the sustainer. He keeps him going. And because of those facts about God, because Jehovah is those things to David, how does David consider the threats of men? He says it twice in different ways. In verse 1. Whom shall I fear? Of whom shall I be afraid? You know, if God is for us, Paul says in Romans 8:31, if God is for us, who can be against us? If you realize that God is on your side, people really may be out to get you. But with God on your side, you shouldn't be terrified. You shouldn't be afraid. He's your light. He is your salvation. He is your strength, your sustainer. And so there's no need to fear as men otherwise might. If you look at Psalm 56, and I'll try to bring in several other psalms into this discussion, which we'll not cover in our study, but which relate to some of these same themes. In Psalm 56, verses 3 and 4, whenever I am afraid, I will trust in you. In God, I will praise His word. In God, I have put my trust. I will not fear. What can flesh do to me? So if you're trusting God, you have this covenant relationship with God. The worst that could possibly happen is that God might allow someone to take your life, but they can't take your soul. Now, Jesus said, don't fear him that can kill the body but is not able to kill the soul, but fear him who's able to destroy both body and soul in hell, referring to God the Father. So the thing is, our protection from God is really eternal. And when our focus is on Him and on spiritual things, we can lift up our heads. We don't have to be afraid. If that's really our viewpoint, if that's really our commitment and confidence in the Lord. David's confidence for the future was based on the past. And I want to say to you that this is a secret to life that David had. Many of us need to learn this secret. But he learned it very, very early on. You might remember when we studied the 23rd Psalm, we talked about David's early days as a shepherd. And then when he goes up to take on Goliath, remember what he says to Saul? Saul says, you can't do this. Well, essentially, he says, I can too, because when I was a shepherd, what came up against me? The lion and the bear. And so I was successful there because God helped me. And I know that this Philistine will be just like one of those. And so the secret that I'm sharing with you, that David is sharing with us, is that his past experience in being helped by God leads him to have a lot of confidence in his future and being helped by God. Now, that's something, if we look back on our lives over the path that we've trod, if we're honest with ourselves, we can see many times when God has helped us through tough situations, can't we? Now, to most of us, that's just, well, you know, so here I am now. Well, I've got this next tough situation or this one that I'm in right now. And somehow all of that back there doesn't apply to all of this right here or to my future. But to David, it did. All of that back there that God had seen him through meant that right now in the present and on into the future, he could have confidence. He didn't have to be afraid. He knew that God would be with him. It's like driving with your headlights. You know, your headlights have been working all this time and shown you the way to go just far enough so you can penetrate through the darkness and get to the next thing. And we trust our headlights, don't we? You know, and if you've ever had them go out at night for some reason, you realize how much you need them. But we trust them all the time. Well, David trusts all the miles of road behind him that have hit his, you know, the headlights have been faithful. God is his light. God is his light into the future. And he trusts that. And so with that kind of in our heads, think about again what he's saying. In verse 2, when the wicked came up against me to eat up my flesh, my enemies and foes, they stumbled and fell. That's all past tense, isn't it? You see what I'm saying? That's all in the past. And so then look at verse 3. Though an army may encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war may rise against me, in this I will be confident. That's all future. His past experience leads to his present and future confidence. That's exactly what's being expressed in those two verses. And so you can go over to like Psalm 118, for instance, in verses 5 and 6. And you have this same sort of synthetic parallelism where one thing sort of leads to the next. I called on the Lord in distress. The Lord answered me and set me in a broad place. The Lord is on my side. So, you know, again, past tense, I called on the Lord. This is Psalm 118, verse 5. He answered me, set me in a broad place, so I did well. Well, present tense, the Lord is on my side. I will not fear, future. What can man do to me? Same sort of thought process. And this is you see it over and over and over again in David's approach to living, in his approach to living a life of faith. And we so badly need to adopt this same approach to living a life of faith ourselves today. I think it's one of the things that we're often missing, and one of the reasons that we get so down and out and troubled about our troubles. In 2 Samuel chapter 7, after David had been made king and things were really going well, he's sort of at the peak, at the zenith of his life, he's sort of at the top of the heap, so to speak. In 2 Samuel chapter 7, God promises him that he'd raise up his son to sit on his throne forever and all of that sort of thing. In the earlier verses, if you get to verse 18, David takes the long look back and he realizes everything that God has done for him to bring him to this point. And King David went in and sat before the Lord and said, "Who am I, O Lord God, and what is my house that you have brought me this far?" He realizes that God had brought him to this point. That God had brought him to this point. And that made all the difference for him. He has confidence in the Lord. When we get back to Psalm 27, he has such confidence in the Lord. It doesn't matter if the wicked are coming against him, if the enemies are coming to eat up his flesh, if there's an army. And that actually did happen to him on more than one occasion. An entire army basically encamped against him. We see these, of course, I say we see. I've never seen a Rambo movie, for instance, but one of these, you know, mythical heroes that goes up against a whole army and faces them down. David was one of those kinds of heroes, a real one, who more than one time in his life faced whole armies of people, and sometimes virtually single-handedly. I can remember an early experience where he and Jonathan take out a bunch of Philistines, just the two of them, and other things in his life. Of course, facing Goliath and all of that horde of the Philistines. So in any case, he faces all of that, and he has confidence. In Psalm 27, then, in verse 4, he moves from his confidence in the Lord and the reason for it to his commitment to communion with God. One thing I have desired of the Lord, that will I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in His temple. I have a sermon that I preached years ago. I haven't preached it in several years, I don't guess. But being reminded of it here, I think the title of it is One Thing. And you might remember when the rich young ruler came to Jesus and Jesus told him to keep all the commands. And he said, well, I've done all that. And what did Jesus say then? One thing you lack. One thing you lack. Go and sell all you have, give it to the poor, come follow me. You lack, what you lack is a commitment. What you lack really is a commitment. Paul said, this one thing I do, Philippians 3, forgetting the things that are behind, stretching forward to the things that are ahead, I press. I have total commitment to my Lord. And it's amazing how many times there are two or three other occasions where one thing, the one thing that God expects is a complete commitment. It's a complete commitment. And that is what is in this passage. There's one thing I desire, and more than anything else, that's to be with my God. To dwell in His house with Him. No matter what else happens, if I can do that, if I can have that, everything else is going to be all right. So when you have that total, total commitment to communion with God, this one thing that David desires. If you go back to Psalm 26, just a few verses earlier, really, in the Psalms, Psalm 26 in verse 8, same sort of thing being expressed. Lord, I have loved the habitation of your house and the place where your glory dwells. I've loved it. I love the habitation of your house. I love where you are, and I want to be where you are. And the reasons that he says this, and the benefits of having this communion with God that he mentions, he wants to be there to behold the beauty of the Lord, you know, because it's such a wonderful thing to be in the presence of God. And then the benefits of it are to inquire in His temple. One of the things when you have communion with God, when you're living your life in the presence of God, you can always talk to God. You can always ask Him. David recognized the importance of having a close communal relationship with God, living with God, abiding with Him, having God abide in his life, dwelling in the tabernacle, so to speak, in the dwelling place of God. And when you're there, then it's like, well, it's like people that you live with. Katie's sitting back here, you know, Sandy, my wife, we live in the same house. I can ask any one of them anything, anytime. We see each other all the time, right? God's right there with you. And so you can inquire of Him. You can ask Him. And what a great relationship. David relied on that sort of relationship. He enjoyed the benefits of being able to inquire. And then realizing that God's going to protect him. If David is where God is, in the pavilion of the tabernacle, just imagine somebody trying to break into God's house and do something to hurt the family of God. Well, you've got the greatest protector that there ever could possibly be, the God of all creation. And you're dwelling where He is, and somebody's going to try to break into His house. Do you feel protected? You know, that's better than any security alarm. It's better than any watchdog. It's better than anything we could ever think of to protect us. That's the concept David is sharing with us. Listen again as you think about it in that way. He says in verse 5, "For in time of trouble he shall hide me in his pavilion, in the secret place of his tabernacle he shall hide me, he shall set me high upon a rock." So my protection is from God, and I'm in his house, I'm in his place, and none can assail me there. And so he is capable of praying to God, inquiring. He's being protected by God, and all of that leads to wonderful praise that he offers to God. "My head is lifted up above my enemies all around." He's got people all around are against him, and yet God is lifting up his head. He's not bowed down. He's not in fear. He's not terrified of what's going to happen next. But God is his strength. And so, when you're in that situation, you're very free, and you feel free to praise and worship God. You know, what a wonderful thing. And so God has done all of this for him, and here's what he says. "Therefore I will offer sacrifices of joy in his tabernacle." I think the margin says joyous shouts. He's just exhilaratingly happy. He says, "I will sing, yes, I will sing praises to the Lord." This is why many times, had a discussion like this not too long ago with some of our young people. What can we do to make our singing better? What can we do to make our singing better? How about a class on how to hit all the notes or conduct, you know? We could do a lot of different things. What's really going to make our singing better? If our heart's right. That's right. If our heart's right. And when you're in a situation where David is and your heart is right, you sing the praises, and it'll be a lot better. It'll be a lot better because it's coming from the heart. That's the intention. All right, let's move ahead to the next little section of this psalm, where you have the central point, I suppose, is this prayer for mercy and deliverance from God, verses 7 on through about verse 12. "Hear, O Lord, when I cry with my voice, have mercy also upon me and answer me." Well, he knows, doesn't he, that God is going to do that because he's dwelling in his house. He has, as we've already expressed, a lot of confidence along that line. He pleads, though, for this. He said, "Because you've asked me to seek your face, and I have sought your face, therefore I know you're going to answer me." Now, I did some study, and it's kind of interesting. I don't remember ever having studied this particular phrase before, the idea of seeking the face of God, or what it means for God's face to be turned upon you. I know, of course, the passage in Numbers, which I think we should look at for just a minute, is pretty instructive along this line. If you look at Numbers chapter 6, look at that. This is the way that the priests were commanded to bless the people in sort of a liturgical format. Aaron and his sons, this is how they were to bless the children of Israel in Numbers chapter 6, verse 23. "Speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. So they shall put my name on the children of Israel, and I will bless them." With that in mind, what do you think it means for a person to seek the face of the Lord? What are we seeking when we seek the face of the Lord? His approval? His notice? His attention? Yeah. And from that, because you have his attention, his blessing. You see that specifically in this text. When my face is shining on them, I'm going to bless them. Because they have my attention. And I'll see to their needs. And I'll look after them. So, when you get back to Psalm 27, when God said to David, "Seek my face," that is to say, you seek my attention so that I'll bless you, and I will bless you. So David said, "You said seek your face, and I did seek your face." And so now, what's David's expectation? He's going to bless me like He said He would. I did what, you know, I sought Him. I sought His help. I sought His attention. And He told me to do that. I did that. And so there's a lot of confidence now just sort of oozing from David as he sees this. If you look in some of the Psalms, let's just flip through some of them quickly. Psalm 105 and verse 4. There are a number of references to this sort of thing. Psalm 105 and verse 4, "Seek the Lord and His strength. Seek His face evermore." Now, there's a command for us to seek His face. In Psalm 67, in verse 1, "Be merciful to us and bless us, and cause God be merciful to us and bless us, and cause His face to shine upon us." So you see that this idea of the face shining on us, again, is symbolic of His blessing. In Psalm 80 and verse 3, Psalm 80 and verse 3, look at that. "Restore us, O God, cause Your face to shine, and we shall be saved." Then in verse 7, Psalm 80 and verse 7, "Restore us, O God of hosts, cause Your face to shine, and we shall be saved." Repeating the same thing. In Psalm 69, verses 16 and 17, "Hear me, O Lord, for Your loving kindness is good. Turn to me according to the multitude of Your tender mercies, and do not hide Your face from Your servant." I love that imagery. Turn to me, and do not hide Your face from Your servant. So that's the approach that David has in Psalm 143, verses 7 and 8. "Answer me speedily, O Lord. My spirit fails. Do not hide Your face from me, lest I be like those who go down to the pit. Cause me to hear Your loving kindness in the morning, for in You do I trust. Cause me to know the way in which I should walk." So again, this is somewhat, it's a secret to living a life of faith. How many times as we're going through life and going through these hard times do we first and foremost seek the attention of God, seek His face to be upon us as we're going through this? I think, I'm afraid a lot of times it's the last thing we think of. I mentioned this not too long ago in a sermon, but we have difficulties in our lives and this and that, things happening, and somebody says, "Well, have you prayed about it?" "Well, no, I haven't thought to pray about it." Well, that should be the first thing that we do. Instead of trying to solve it ourselves and worry about it and fret through it, is to seek God's face and His blessing and His attention. And then when that happens, then you have confidence that the Lord is going to help you even if everybody else in the world forsakes you, even if you are all alone. And as we've said, David was all alone at times, seemingly completely by himself. Of course, there were others who were on his side, but there were times when he was by himself. And suppose, there in 1 Samuel 22, his parents are among those who come into the cave there. But as I said earlier, he actually takes them over to Moab and puts them in the charge of the keeping of the king of Moab while he's going through all this difficult time. So he's without his parents. His parents really haven't deserted him, but you know, he's without their support at a pretty critical time in his young life when he's going through all of this with Saul. When you get back to Psalm 27, I think you see a sort of an echo of that. He says in verse 9, "Do not hide Your face from me. Do not turn Your servant away in anger. You've been my help. Do not leave me nor forsake me, O God of my salvation. When my father and my mother forsake me, then the Lord will take care of me." Even when your father and your mother would forsake you, the Lord will take care of you. There's a tremendous passage in Isaiah chapter 49. Isaiah chapter 49. In verse 15, when you first read this, it's one of those passages where you think you know where it's going, but it doesn't go where you think it is. Let me just read this first part of it. Isaiah 49, in verse 15. "Can a woman forget her nursing child and not have compassion on the son of her womb?" Well, that sounds like it's just a rhetorical question. And you say, no, a mother can't forget her child. But read the rest of it. Surely they may forget. So as impossible as that seems, it might be, barely possible that a woman could actually just forget her child. I suppose that in the whole world there are a small percentage that are capable of doing that. But he says, surely they may forget, yet the Lord says, yet I will not forget you. When you're deserted by everybody else, God promises, I will not forget you. This promise was made to the children of Israel, to Zion. And he says in the next verse, just a beautiful image in my mind, see, I have inscribed you on the palm of my hands. You ever done that? When something you didn't want to forget, somebody's telling you some information, you don't have paper or anything, you got a pen maybe, and so you write it on the palm of your hand so you don't forget. God says, I have inscribed you on the palm of my hand. Everybody else may forget you, but I've got you right here. I remember who you are and what your needs are. Well, back in Psalm 27, David does huge confidence in the Lord, even though everybody else may forsake him. He trusts God in every aspect. He trusts him for direction in his life. Look at verse 11. Teach me your way, O Lord, and lead me in a smooth path because of my enemies. One of the marginal translations there, instead of smooth, is plain. And that may be a little bit preferable, a plain path. But the concept is he needs to know the way he should go, and it should be a way that he can walk in. He's got lots of other troubles around, but just if God will just show him how he should go in life, then he's going to take that path. This, again, the same sentiment back in Psalm 25. Show me your ways in verse 4, Psalm 25, verse 4. Show me your ways, O Lord. Teach me your paths. Lead me in your truth and teach me. For you are the God of my salvation. On you I wait all the day. So he's pleading with God for direction and promising God that he will take that direction. And he's also pleading back in the 27th Psalm, then in verse 12, to be delivered from the will of dishonest and untrue adversaries. He says in verse 12 again, do not deliver me to the will of my adversaries, for false witnesses have risen against me, and such as breathe out violence. Most of us, probably in our lives, again, if we've lived very long, have had the experience of somebody telling a lie on you, as we say, a lie about you, a false accusation. In my life, there's hardly a more wretched feeling than that, when somebody's lying on you and maybe even getting a lot of other people to believe some horrendous untruth about you that you know is untrue to the core, and they know, probably the person that originated it knows is untrue as well, but they're just trying. And in David's life, of course, Saul, in his mental instability, made up a lot of things about David and told them as true, which were not true. And that sort of spread from there. Saul talked about what an enemy David was and how David was out to get him and usurp his throne and all of that sort of thing, and had a lot of people convinced and so that was the kind of thing David had to deal with a lot. He says, don't deliver me to the will of these adversaries, these false witnesses, who've said things and believed things that are not true about me. In Proverbs 25 and verse 18, here's how that makes us feel. A man who bears false witness against his neighbor is like a club, a sword, and a sharp arrow. A club hurts. A sword hurts. A sharp arrow really hurts. Somebody who bears false witness hurts. That hurts. But David's relying on God to deliver him from all of that. So there's his prayer for mercy and deliverance. And even as he's praying for help and for mercy and for protection, do you see so much confidence infused, so much trust infused in the words that he speaks. The last couple of verses, you have what I'd call the testimony of faith and patience. Again, David looks back on his experiences and he says, I would have lost heart. That particular phrase is not it's not in the original Hebrew. It's supplied by the translators, but I think it's one of those that's a pretty good supply. It is the sense of actually what's being said here. He says, I would have lost heart unless I had believed that I would see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. What's he saying there? Is there a time when he might have just given up? He might have just quit? He might have just been so eaten up with his darkness and despair that it just overcame him? Maybe. But what sustained him through that? He believed. He believed. Faith, your faith in God is what sustains you through that. And the whole thing, this whole thing has to do with trusting God. Trusting God completely. He'd so many times before, as we've already said, in his past life, he knew that God had helped him and he believed he'd see that again. Romans 8:28, we know that all things work together for good to those who love the Lord. Do we know that? All things work together for good to those who love the Lord. That's not a promise that, you know, every day is going to be sunshine and rainbows, but it is a promise that as everything works out, it'll work out for your betterment into eternity and for your blessing into eternity. All things work together for good to those who love the Lord. And so David recognizes that. He knows that he's going to see the goodness of the Lord. And he says, in the land of the living, and I assume he means this land. Although, probably many of you have heard the story about when Brother Gardner Hall Sr. was Bill and Sewell's dad was passing from this life, and someone went in and asked him, basically he was on his deathbed and said, well, are you still in the land of the living? He said, no, but I'm headed there. So the real land of the living is the one that we're going to. But in any case, I think David is talking about the here and now. And he knows that God's goodness will be in the here and now. And so his encouragement to us is, because all of this is the case, in verse 14, wait on the Lord. I don't know how many times in Scripture, the Psalms particularly, but I should have probably counted them all up for this lesson, but how many times we're told to wait on the Lord. Wait. We get so impatient. I'm going to probably talk about some of this tonight in tonight's sermon. But we get so impatient with God. Why didn't you answer this sooner? Why haven't you answered this yet? You know, Mike? Well, I think that's included in it. This idea Mike is saying of not so much just sitting there doing nothing, but as a servant waits on his master, you continue to serve and you just trust the master to take care of things. I think that's certainly a part of it. Great encouragement. All right, well, we're going to quit there. Appreciate everybody's attention this morning. We go on in our lessons. Psalm 32 will be the one that we look at in our next class. Psalm 32, the blessedness of confessing sin.